The North Carolina Reading Service now presents the following program for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. Plink. That plink, plink, plink tells me to start telling you that this is the Indie Week, the Independent. I'm John Federson with this weekly issue of the Indie Week, and it dated January the 29th of 2026. That's a good fade out, John. You get bonus points for that one. And let's get started with this issue of Indie Week. And our opening article has appeared on the printed front page of the Independent of Indie Week just today, and the title, A National Model, How One Program is Preparing Durham Youth for Life Science Careers. The Research Triangle has been a major science and technology hub for decades. In 1984, as the tobacco and textile industry, long-standing pillars of the North Carolina economy, moved overseas, academic and business leaders saw the writing on the wall and urged the legislatures to welcome a burgeoning industry to the Tar Heel State, life sciences. Across the state, the biotechnology sector has grown 38% since 2018, now home to more than 840 life sciences companies. Economic growth in life sciences and biotechnology across the state far outpaces nationwide growth. According to the NC Biotechnology Center, life science and biotech companies invested over $7.6 billion between 2020 and 2022 alone, adding more than 6,000 new jobs. But they had a problem filling the positions. Many of the jobs created by these investments offer starting salaries at or above the living wage, plus benefits, and don't require advanced degrees. Durham Technical Community College offered the requisite degree and certificate programs in partnership with ENC Biotech, but leading up to the COVID pandemic, enrollment was stagnating. In 2020, when most of the economy was retreating inward and folks were leaving the office, the pharmaceutical industry ramped up, heightening the need for new employees. But not enough Durham residents were taking advantage of the programs to fill the available jobs. Made in Durham, a nonprofit founded in 2014 that focuses on strengthening the education-to-career system for Durham residents, joined forces with city and county staff, Durham Tech, the Durham Chamber of Commerce, and NC Biotech, to come up with a solution for matching these high-quality job opportunities with candidates at a time when jobs were scarce. Through funding from NC Biotech, Durham Tech was able to offer free tuition for anyone to enroll in its BioWorks certificate program, while Made in Durham worked with community partners to recruit students. That year, enrollment in the BioWorks program increased by 300%. Durham Tech and its partners succeeded in attracting more future employees into the life sciences career pipeline, but a significant demographic of Durham residents were still being left out. About one in five young adults aged 16 to 25 were neither in school nor working. In Durham, many of those youth belonged to communities of color. Now, this is a pause in this actual story that I'm reading from the Indie Week's news line on online, Indie Week, and it's called Durham Newsmakers. It's about two paragraphs, and it involves the Indie and the Assembly Network, which is going to hold a detailed conversation on how Durham is innovating to meet future workforce needs. Two reporters will lead the audience through a series of conversations with folks at the forefront of Durham's economic future, including Durham Technical Community College President J.B. Buxton and head of alliance development at Novo Nordisk, Nicole Niwa. When's that going to take place? It will happen at the Full Frame Theater at ATC, that's the American Tobacco Campus, in Durham. It's going to be February the 4th, and it's going to be 5 p.m. There are tickets, and there's a website for tickets, probably through the Indy. If you happen to be a member of the Indy Press Club, that's a subscription version of Indy Week, you can get in for free. Let's see. So, now we'll return to the article. Casey Steinbacher, executive director at Made in Durham, who served as president of the Durham Chamber when Made in Durham was created, said when what we saw about these communities of color was people that really didn't need our help. In 2021, Made in Durham created the Bulls Life Science Academy to recruit young adults into the BioWorks program at Durham Tech and help them prepare for careers in the industry. The first cohort included 5 students. Made in Durham received a grant from the Oak Foundation for $50,000 to provide stipends for the students. At the end of the inaugural program, 2 out of 5 students passed. But where graduation rates fell short, program leadership learned a lot. Durham County, already a funding partner for Made in Durham, offered $250,000 apiece to Made in Durham and Durham Tech to beef up that Bulls initiative. Now, Dominique Oliver, director of strategic initiatives at Made in Durham, says Bulls was not just about increasing enrollment for Durham Tech, but about meeting the industry needs and building a pipeline for economic prosperity for Durham's young adult residents. Oliver says, when the Bulls started, it didn't start as a Durham Tech solution, and it's not a Durham Tech solution. What we were looking at was an industry problem. The industry had a huge talent pool they were missing because Durham residents were not getting those life science jobs. Figuring out the right model for the program has taken years of tinkering. At the end of every cohort, Steinbacher says Bulls partners all met to debrief and make adjustments. A major boost came when Made in Durham received federal funding through that American Rescue Plan Act and the Build Back Better Act, which the organization used to pay other local community groups to help with recruitment and become ambassadors for Bulls Academy. But again, it was not just about getting students in the door. They needed to get them across the stage on graduation day. On average, the first 5 cohorts posted a graduation rate of just 55%. Academic coaches were already provided to these students through Durham Tech, but Made in Durham worked with the college to add success coaches that not only support student academics but prepare students for life as a professional by helping with resume writing, preparing for job interviews, and learning how to navigate the life science industry. In addition to free tuition, students also are granted a $10,000 stipend to provide financial support for life expenses like housing and transportation. Students receive a portion of this stipend for participation. The other half is based on academic performance throughout the program. And this creates incentives for the students to stay engaged and see the program through till the end. The final step, getting students into the workforce. Made in Durham expanded its corporate partnership staff to better connect students with professionals in the field, as well as bring businesses into the program to meet with students. All of these adjustments led to improvements in student achievement. Steinbacher said, the students needed to understand this was not an activity to get a job. This was an activity to start a career. Constant iteration allowed the program to finally catch its wind. The next 6 cohorts graduated 93% of its students, who were also having better success in the job market. In the first couple of cohorts, Steinbacher says, about 1 in 7 got a job within the first 3 months. After deepening corporate partnerships and expanding the number of success coaches, 1 in 3 instead of 1 in 7 made that same benchmark. Since the program started, over 200 students have graduated from Bowles, with 77 of them in the field of life sciences across 22 different companies. The Bowles Life Science Academy is currently recruiting for its 14th cohort. Students that join Bowles are enrolled as students in Durham Tech for a 5-month certification program in life sciences. Students must be 18 to 25 years old, have a high school diploma or equivalent certification, reside in Durham County, and pass a drug and background check. Interested students have to attend an orientation on life sciences before they can even apply, giving them a better understanding for what to expect in the field once they complete the program. Compared to other industries, the certification for life sciences is more universally accepted by businesses. Oliver said, one of the big things about life science that's different from a lot of other jobs is that there's one certification that all companies recognize. So, when we're looking at the way we structure Bowles and the reason we chose the classes we did, it really gives our students the best opportunity to create a full pipeline for all of those life science companies. Students who finish the program can take their newfound talents into the job market. Others return to pursue further education by completing an associate's degree in biotechnology or transferring to a 4-year university. Participants have gone on to work at Novo Nordisk. That's the Danish pharmaceutical company that produces popular weight loss and diabetes drugs, Ozempic and Wegovy, which opened a new facility in Durham in 2019. After already investing more than $2 billion in nearby Clayton, and Novartis, a global pharmaceutical company which announced last November it was constructing 2 new facilities in Durham as part of a $23 billion U.S.-based infrastructure investment. Other multinational pharmaceutical companies like Merck and Lilly have also hired Bowles graduates. Landing a job in life sciences for Bowles graduates can be a game changer. Starting salaries for some positions go as high as $80,000, far above the poverty line in Durham and higher than the minimum living wage. And the opportunities don't stop there. Employees in life science industry are well positioned for upward mobility. Steinbacher had this to say, life science companies are one of the most well-known industry sectors to invest in your personal education. They've dedicated funding for each position to keep them growing in the industry. That's why we tell everybody it's not just a job. The Research Triangle, with its acclaimed education system and healthcare institutions, as well as investments from local and state governments, has the ideal conditions to support the continued growth of life science and biotechnology industries that have made a home in the region. Unlike jobs at tech companies, many of which are remote and can employ people from around the world, life science companies are choosing Durham because of the local talent and training infrastructure already available, making Durham competitive and attracting other life science companies to the region, even though building facilities may be cheaper elsewhere. And now, thanks to programs like Made in Durham, the workforce pipeline is stronger than ever, especially for residents in Durham's disadvantaged communities. Over the past 4 years, Durham County has invested $2 million in the Bowles program, while Bowles graduates are bringing in over $3 million in salaries. a significant return on the taxpayers' investment. County Commissioner Wendy Jacobs says, "I believe the Bulls program is a national model and is one of the most important things that the county is doing." The Durham County Board of Commissioners proclaimed January the 12th Bulls Academy Life Sciences Day in honor of the program's accomplishments. And Wendy Jacobs said, "This is about structural systems change. This is the kind of program we have to keep investing in to really transform economic mobility in Durham and make sure that young people, especially young people of color, are directly connected and prepared for the good-paying jobs we have in Durham." Bulls Academy now gets twice as many applications as they can accept, Steinbacher says, and the program hopes to take its model and grow workforce training in other sectors too. Steinbacher says parents are some of the biggest cheerleaders of the program. At a graduation last year, an enthusiastic mother who had already sent two kids through the program told Steinbacher she was sad not to have more kids to enroll in Bulls Academy. 20 minutes later, Steinbacher says the mother came back beaming. She had convinced her niece to give the program a shot. Finally, Steinbacher said parents are very, very supportive of it. They come to the graduation, they yell and scream, and they have a good time. And just about every kid in this program would tell you, once their parent found out about Bulls, they were taking it, whether they wanted to or not. Now, next, another education-related article about UNC Chapel Hill, which is developing a satellite campus at Carolina North. And this begins with an update saying that the university's Board of Trustees last week voted to allow the school to spend up to $8 million of its trust funds for planning efforts. And now the article. It's happening. Nearly 20 years after UNC Chapel Hill leaders proposed a mixed-use extension of the university's main campus, Chancellor Lee Roberts on Wednesday announced plans to develop part of the property known as Carolina North. Carolina North spans several hundred acres off Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, about 2 miles north of the Chapel Hill campus, including a 750-acre forest with public trails. The university will develop about 230 acres at the site of the former Horace Williams Airport, which closed in 2018, and turned it into, quote, a full-blown satellite campus, Roberts told the assembly ahead of the official announcement at a board meeting. The new campus is expected to include academic and research facilities, retail, and housing for both students, with space planned for 2,000 undergrads in the development's initial phase, and Chapel Hill residents. But the university is punting for now on whether Carolina North will become the new home of the men's basketball team, an idea that's been floated for more than a year but has garnered significant pushback in recent weeks. Roberts said in the interview, UNC Chapel Hill is still gathering feedback on plans for a basketball arena. Now, the plan to develop the airport area was not unexpected. After becoming chancellor 2 years ago, Roberts identified Carolina North as a key asset to some of his strategic priorities, like boosting the engineering offerings and the growing enrollment. Still, the move marks a major shift for Chapel Hill, the university said in a news release that it will be the largest expansion of the school's physical footprint since its founding more than 230 years ago. In the interview, Roberts framed the decision to develop this property as central to the university's mission to serve North Carolina, particularly as the state experiences significant population growth. It will also help fill demand for affordable housing and encourage partnerships between the university and those science and tech companies in the private sector. We can't sit in a bubble and watch the state continue to grow and change around us without responding, said Roberts. And in Roberts' eyes, Carolina North was an opportunity ripe for the taking. For me, he said, it's surprising we haven't taken advantage of the site until now. He focused on real estate at an investment company he founded before he became chancellor. Quote, most universities would do anything to have this kind of developable land this close to the existing campus, and so I think it's long overdue. The school attributes the lack of development at Carolina North after initial planning in 2007 to, quote, a sustained period of constrained resources that stemmed from the Great Recession. Roberts estimated it will take about 20 years for the development to be fully built, though there will be significant progress in the next few years. Groundbreaking on construction is slated for summer 2027, says the university news release. Eventually, the site will be connected to the main campus by a planned bus rapid transit route. Chapel Hill town officials say will begin service in 2029. Roberts said the university won't rely on state funding for the project, though campus officials think it would be money well spent if lawmakers offered it. The State House and Senate last year each proposed allocating funds to develop a conceptual site plan for Carolina North, but a months-long standoff between the chambers meant they didn't pass a full budget. The Board of Trustees of UNC Chapel Hill voted to allow the school to spend up to $8 million of its trust funds for these planning efforts, like issuing requests for master planning, infrastructure design, and the development of the property over the coming months. University said the total cost of this phase of development will be determined after that planning stage. The big question, though, for many alumni, what will happen to the Dean E. Smith Center, where the Tar Heels have played for 40 years? The arena needs upgrades, including a new roof, improvements to restrooms and concessions, and changes required by disability laws, which Roberts has estimated would cost about $80 million. Building a new arena at Carolina North would allow for a, quote, modern facility with more premium seating that could drive revenue in the increasingly expensive landscape of college athletics. The satellite campus would also lend itself to an entertainment district around the arena, which Roberts compared to the mixed-use battery district that now houses the Atlanta Braves. The Wall Street Journal last year described the team as an economic juggernaut, and Roberts thinks basketball could be the same for Carolina North. The Board of Trustees last summer also heard a proposal to build a cricket stadium, an idea that does not appear to have progressed. But many Tar Heel faithful are not on board with the idea of moving the team from Smith Center, as evidenced by a December letter that roughly 90 former UNC basketball players, coaches, trustees, and donors sent to Roberts expressing their desire for the arena to remain on campus and easily accessible for students. The pro-Smith Center faction has ramped up their campaign in recent days, with former coach Roy Williams appearing in a social media video calling on the university to renovate that arena instead of relocating it. Roberts told the assembly there's no perfect solution, though officials think moving the arena, to Carolina North could be a good solution. What's not an option is the status quo, said Roberts. We have to invest, make significant capital investments no matter what we do, even if the decision were to remain in Smith Center. As part of the planning efforts for Carolina North, the university plans to tap an advisory group of faculty, students, alumni, trustees, and members of the Chapel Hill community. There will be a separate group focused on the arena, said Roberts. Quote, clearly, we have more work to do in gaining as much feedback as we can, as much advice as we can. So we're embarked in a sincere effort to try to solicit that feedback. And he said, putting an arena at the site is not a do or die decision. Carolina North, he said, is going to be an attractive destination no matter what. And back to Durham and elections coming up. Candidates for the upcoming election. Two of Durham's most influential political organizations announced their slates of candidates. The People's Alliance, PAC, and the PAC associated with the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People, endorsed in 14 contested races that will be on the ballot March the 3rd. March the 3rd, including Democratic primaries and the nonpartisan Durham School Board general elections, as well as a handful of uncontested races that will appear on ballots in the November general election. For more explanation on how each PAC carries out their endorsement, Indy has made coverage of the 2025 city council elections, which obviously have already gone half. And you can look at the Indy Week website if you want to find a coverage of that. There's a link provided in this story, which I cannot give you. Perhaps characteristically for fickle politics in Durham, the two PACs endorsement overlapped in exactly half the 14 contested races. For a local candidate, winning that pair of endorsements often means they are set to coast to a comfortable election. It's less clear what it means for a candidate who wins only one of the endorsements, especially as the influence of and unity within the PACs has waxed and waned over a turbulent era of Durham politics. Well, here's how the endorsements break down. First, an expected split for Congress. In the race for the 4th Congressional District, which covers all of Durham and Orange counties, as well as pieces of Wake and Chatham, the People's Alliance, that's PA, the PA PAC, endorsed the challenger Nida Alam, while the committee PAC endorsed incumbent Valerie Fouché. That mirrors a split in 2022, when Fouché won her first congressional election by 9 points. In an interview with Indy, Floyd McKissick Jr., the committee's chair, cited Fouché's excellent leadership, in quotes, as well as her extensive experience serving at all levels of local government before ascending to Congress. Javiera Caballera, a Durham City Council member, who is also a PA member, told Indy that Alam, a county commissioner, is, quote, in this moment in particular, a reflection of what we need broadly. The PACs both threw their support behind Myra Griffin for an open Superior Court seat, as well as incumbent Sheriff Clarence Burkhead. Incumbent Durham County Superior Court Clerk Amina Thompson and the incumbent District 22 State Senator Sophia Chitley. That endorsement may make things more difficult for Chitlick's challenger, former City Council member Didriana Freeman, who most recently had won the committee's endorsement in her unsuccessful bid to keep her City Council seat last year. McKissick said Chitlick, quote, has done an excellent job in reaching out to her constituents and in really reflecting the voice of her district. Citing Chitlick's work in helping to launch the state's first black-owned birthing center. The PA PAC endorsed incumbent Durham District Attorney Satana DeBerry, while the committee PAC opted for the challenger, Jonathan Wilson. McKissick said not as many people spoke out on DeBerry's behalf during deliberations, while Wilson had a, quote, high level of visibility as he chaired the committee's legal redress subcommittee until he recently became a candidate. The PACs split their decisions for Court of Appeals, Seat 3, Committee, James Whalen, PA, Christine Valtzix. District Court Judge, District 16, Seat 2. Committee, Doretta Walker, PA, no endorsement. And District Court Judge, District 16, Seat 5. Committee, Clayton Jones, PA, Christy Mallett. That's a second notable win for Jones, Clayton Jones, this month, as he was recently found not guilty on domestic violence charges. The Durham School Board now is set to get a major shakeup this year. Of the 7 seats, 4 are up for election, and 3 incumbents have opted not to run. The Durham Association of Educators, that's DAE, recruited and endorsed a slate of 4 candidates with the goal of keeping their hard-fought meet-and-confer policy. This is in lieu of the state allowing labor unions or union representatives to bargain. An announcement from the union described their endorsees as leaders who will not only defend our meet-and-confer policy, but also hold DPS administration accountable to using it as it was designed. That is a not-so-thinly-veiled reference to the tension of this year's new and public sessions between the superintendent's team and the union's leadership. Durham is something of a laboratory right now, with the first in the state policy that is meant to empower workers to give input without violating the state's ban on public sector collective bargaining. The superintendent answers only to the Board of Education, which answers only to voters. If the workers' union lands 4 hand-picked candidates on the school board, the district's org chart becomes more complicated. DAE previously, in 2022 and 24, endorsed each of the 7 current board members. Those relationships have soured, and the DAE has not been so keen on any of them in the past year, though this year's crop of candidates seem optimistic about being able to maintain a more positive relationship with the union. Of the dozen candidates in the race, 3 for each of the 4 seats, the PA PAC endorsed the 4 DAE-backed candidates. That's Natalie Brent Kataif, Nadine Beer, Gabrielle Rivero, and Xavier Quezon. The committee PAC seconded Brent Kataif and Quezon and endorsed Bettina Umstead, the only incumbent running, and Lauren Sartain. And finally, early voting again, ahead of March 3rd election begins, guess what, folks, February the 12th. And, of course, Indy Week carries running and detailed election coverage for all these periods. A vigil, candlelight vigil at the Veterans Administration, where Durham nurses mourn Alex Pretty. More than 100 gathered in front of the gates of Durham VA's Medical Center Wednesday night for a candlelit vigil honoring Alex Pretty, the VA nurse who was shot and killed by federal agents in Minneapolis on Saturday. Clutching tea lights and bouquets of flowers, attendees formed a line down the sidewalk that stretched so far from the main gate. Different sections of the crowd took on different purposes. Those near the front listened to speeches, while those further back out of earshot sang songs of solidarity. Many held signs, one that read, "Stop lying, nurses can spot a fib," nodded to both the contested official narrative of Pretty's death and to a fib. That's a cardiac arrhythmia that nurses routinely detect. Pretty worked as an intensive care nurse at the VA healthcare system, and on January 24th, he was pepper sprayed and fatally shot by federal immigration agents after filming the agents with his phone and attempting to help a protester whom agents had knocked to the pavement. Libby Manley, a nurse at Durham VA, told Indy, "The fact that he was a nurse is really meaningful. He was a healing person. He was trying to protect a woman who had just violently been shoved to the ground." Brady's murder comes amid an already turbulent period for VA nurses. Since Trump took office last year, the VA has shed tens of thousands of employees, leaving nurses who remain stretched thin. In Durham, that has resulted in VA employees conducting telehealth visits from broom closets and passing out meal trays on top of their regular patient duties, the Indy has previously reported. The Durham Visual was one of dozens held across the country this week as part of a large-scale action organized by the labor union National Nurses United. The union has said that ICE poses a public health threat, in that ICE agents have shot more than a dozen people since September and demanded the agency be abolished. The crowd in Durham included cohorts from various local union chapters. Many of the speeches highlighted the fact that Pretty was a union member and that labor fights and immigrant rights are intertwined. Terrence Dewberry, president of the Triangle Area Labor Council, said this: "They want us to think immigration is a separate issue from labor, but Alex showed them that we are the same fight." Before the vigil ended, organizers encouraged attendees to turn to someone they didn't know, look them in the eye, and say, "Come for one, face for all. I've got your back." Manley said it felt nice to be surrounded by other people, saying, "You can doom scroll all day and read all the terrible news and post about it on your social media, but to actually be with other people who are also upset and feeling the same rage, it's just so impactful," she said. Now, a new play is opening or coming to this area, starting from today to Sunday, February 8th, and that play is named Fatherland. This story about it delves into painful familial fallout from January 6th. The performances, by the way, are at the Mettlesome Theater in Durham at various times of day. It's today through Sunday, February 8th. 5 years after January 6th, Fatherland arrives in Durham, squarely in the midst of a political world divided, with no interest in shying away from the conversation. This is not a courtroom drama play about that day as a headline or an artifact of history. Instead, the Bulldog Ensemble Theater production focuses on the aftermath of the event, what happened when the barricades came down and the people who stormed the Capitol returned home to their families. Opening last January 29th, Fatherland is drawn from the true story of a son who reported his father to the FBI for his role in the Capitol insurrection and contains real courts and transcripts and interviews. Written by Stephen Sachs, the play moves between courtroom testimony and memory theater, with looks back on scenes from the family's life showing both the legal case and what led up to it. Director Marshall Butvinnik said, "It's not a courtroom drama. That's just the frame. What's really happening is a relationship collapsing in real time." At the center is the father-son relationship with North Carolina-based actors Brooke North and Sam Olt, playing father and son, respectively. North's performance resists caricature. His character is not presented as a monster or a punchline, but as a man dangerously convinced that he is acting in defense of his country. North says about his character, he believes he's doing the right thing. He believes he's protecting his family, kids, the future. That belief is sincere. That's what makes it terrifying. The son comes to see the consequences first. Reporting his father becomes an act of both moral clarity and profound loss. Olt described his role as one of forced adulthood. He realizes his dad isn't just flawed, but that he's dangerous. And once you see that, there's no going back. What Fatherland intentionally avoids is easy outrage. There are no triumphant speeches, no cathartic villains. Instead, the play is saturated with fear. Fear for the country, fear for family, fear of what happens when belief detaches from reality. The tension is not necessarily left versus right, but loyalty versus responsibility. Butvinnik notes that political theater often aims to activate anger. Fatherland doesn't. If it works, people won't leap up at the end. They'll just sit there, he said. That lingering effect is reinforced by the production's staging. The play begins with news audios from January 6th, dropping the audience into the noise and confusion of the day as they enter the theater and find their seats. Crucially, Fatherland refuses rote redemption arcs. North said this is not about changing minds. It's about seeing people clearly, even when that's uncomfortable. In the end, Fatherless is less interested in January 6th as a historical event than it is in the questions of what we carry forward, what we lose, and whether family can survive when reality itself becomes contested. Once again, that's opening today, tonight, at the Mettlesome Theater in Durham. And that run will end on February 8th, I believe. Fatherland. Now, I'm recording this on the 29th of January, and last night, Wednesday the 28th, at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, a poet, Diamond Ford, F-O-R-D-E, gave a reading and a talk at that bookstore. And this is an interview with North Carolina poet Diamond Ford. Her grandmother Alice kept her King James Bible close at hand on her nightstand. Ford recalled of his grandmother, who was born in the Jim Crow South and had 8 children. She was one of those older women who got very little sleep, so she'd sleep for 4 hours and go straight into the book for meditation and prayer. If she were talking on the phone in another place in the house and needed it, I would rush off and grab it for her. When her grandmother, Alice, died, Ford inherited that family Bible, a red, worn red leather copy with gold leaf edging, and drew from it for The Book of Alice. That's her second collection of poetry, and it was published January the 20th from Scribner Books. She is an assistant professor at North Carolina State University. Her award-winning 2021 debut collection, Mother Body, touches on some of the same themes as The Book of Alice, like family, identity, survival, and the experience of being a black woman in America. With both her collections, Ford strikes a polished, profound balance of formal innovation and lyrical depth. Writer Keyes Lehman called The Book of Alice ecstatic, and that feels right. The book is organized into 5 sections, each named after books of the Bible, with one apocryphal addition. Weaving between stylized forms, census reports, recipes, that effortlessly reflect their subject, references abound: Toni Morrison, Deutsche, hamhocks, and cicadas. The Book of Alice digs into the stories we inherit, those passed down between generations of family, and those passed down through an ancient text that has offered both comfort and harm to those who hold it close. Alice implores in Womaning, "Dear Lord, why did you make me in your image if you wanted me to kneel?" This question of subjugation is transformed into a granddaughter's brave expression of liberation a few poems later in Acts of Submission, which is a response to the book of Timothy, quote, "You tell me to submit, so I submit, to fish and grits, to the goodwill of well-timed rain. I deserve each earthly pleasure before the world flits into hot mist." In advance of this reading at Quail Ridge, Indy spoke with her about family, faith, and storytelling. The conversation here has been edited and condensed for clarity. Can you tell me about your grandmother, Alice? She is a complicated woman. I think that's what being human requires, that we're all a little bit complicated, that being human means we have our successes and failures. My grandmother was no different. Part of what I'm trying to capture in the book is the successes and failures of my grandmother's survival, and in particular, the way that surviving still manifests in me as a thing that I'm holding on to. But also, she was a human subject to the insecurities of the world, especially as a black woman navigating pre-civil rights America, trying to save both herself and her children, which is probably what led her to her faith the most. When my grandmother couldn't believe in the safety of the world, she could believe in the safety and security of eternal life. Trying to think about what the importance of that investment must have made to her, the ways it would have affected the way she raised my mother, the way that in turn affected the way my mother raised me. My grandmother wasn't perfect. One of the hardest things I had to learn was that my grandmother didn't tell my mother that she loved her. That's a really mind-blowing and difficult thing to learn. But it also means that as a mother, my mom kind of worked double time to make sure I understand how much she loved me. Thinking about inheritances across multiple generations, not just in the Bible she gave me, but in the way she's created a force that shaped how my mother and I have moved through the world, that's part of what I'm trying to unpack in this book. I wanted to ask about that poem where you mention how Alice never told your mother she loved her. In Southern families and families that have experienced trauma, a lot of things are left unsaid. What was the process like of putting and imagining words to things? In any Southern family, especially my own, we're pretty good at weaponizing silence against ourselves and each other. There were times when even the ideas of womanhood were constructed in and through silence. For my family, the harms and navigations of family life were constructed in and through silence. I remember being maybe like 10 years old, a young girl, listening to my mom and my aunts have a conversation with my grandmother. They're talking about my grandmother's last husband, who was incredibly abusive. I also found out later in life that my grandmother didn't know a man who didn't hurt her. As they're talking about this man, my grandmother gets really angry. They're trying to, like, tell my grandmother, he abused you, and she says, no, he didn't. He never did that. He would never do that. He never hit me. And it was really surreal to watch because my mom's face drops. My aunts all look very confused and startled. They were like, what are you talking about, Mom? We had to pull that man off you. We had to call cops. There's this palpable physical violence that lives inside the memories of my mother and my aunts that my grandmother refused to acknowledge and that honestly only hurt herself, truly, right? We have no way of understanding what weaponized or motivated that silence, whether it's some kind of amnesia, a refusal to acknowledge, a whitewashing of the history. I have no way of knowing what was motivating that particular moment. But just because my grandmother doesn't want to acknowledge the hurt and harm doesn't mean that it goes away. One of the things I've had to sit with in the telling of this project is giving voice to those silences that my own family has tried to manufacture, trying to respect the balance between what is my story to tell and what also is the thing I can allow to exist in silence. Trying to tease out those possibilities was probably the most challenging part of trying to write this book. But in doing so, I do hope I found my grandmother's voice in ways that she could not find while she was still here. You have the Bible to work with, but Also, all this ephemera, like recipes and the census, how do family texts work as storytelling vehicles? There's this essay by Sadia Hartman called Venus in Two Acts. In that essay, she talks about the archive of violence that basically shapes black history, in particular during enslavement. She talks about the ways that we can only find evidence of black life through archives that are meant to categorize our death. We're looking at stock lists, at obituaries, at police reports. Taking that as a lens through which you capture history, part of what I wanted to do with this project is to resist that dehumanization. What are the alternative forms of history we often overlook, that are often forgotten, that do signal subjectivity, that do signal humanity, or at least could be put into tension with the ways that they are trying to erase our humanity? We have recipes, which I think are beautiful celebrations of a life, because there it is. It's a life that's contingent on this feeding and this feeding of family. You're not just cooking for yourself. You're cooking for others, reunions, celebrations. There are all those opportunities for joy and wholeness and care that we don't necessarily find in something like a census. We're thinking about these two very different modes of categorizing a person, and how we create or find the tensions of humanity in between those spaces. I'm curious about the book structure. You have Genesis, Exodus, Lamentations, Daughters, Revelations. How did you go about choosing which Bible books to include? Were any of the books on the short list? When I first conceived of it, there were only three: Genesis, Exodus, then I believe Revelations, the last one. In thinking through the arc of the book and thinking through all the poems that were conceived in those sections, I really wanted to think about Origins, which is a beautiful manifestation of Genesis. And Exodus has a parallel of leaving. In particular, Alice's travel northward from the Jim Crow South, but also at the same time, an exploration of her own journey into death, right? Which is its own kind of leaving. And then Revelations, which is kind of like, okay, well, where do we go from here? That joy of leveling is in revelry, is something that I wanted to kind of move toward in the end. As I was looking at the full scope, I realized there were so many different intimacies and minor themes that were being overlooked in some of these books. And so I expanded outward from there. That's when we opened up Lamentation, and that's when I created my own apocryphal book, Daughters. Part of what I was trying to do is look at the Bible as my grandmother's first and true understanding of poetry. It was the only poetry she knew and consumed on a regular basis. So if I wanted to connect with her, I needed to do it through poetry. But also, it was my way of looking into what I thought were gaps in the most canonized texts in the world. Who are the voices that are the most overlooked? The first printing of the Book of Alice has some text in red, the way that Jesus' words are sometimes printed in the Bible. Can you tell me about that style choice? I knew I wanted to play with red letters, but I didn't know whose voice I wanted the red letters to be in. There's always the tension of who plays Savior in a biblical text, and one of the things I wanted to resist was the idea of a Savior. There is no singular Savior in this particular book. That's not something I'm interested in recreating. Instead, when I'm using the red letter text, what I'm trying to highlight is my grandmother's humanity, her ability to speak, the importance of her voice, the thing that we do lose through systemic violence, but also through time, through death, to resurrect her voice as a means of understanding who she is, but also, most importantly, who I am. There is a clear tension in the fact I am the one constructing this voice, thinking about the tensions between what moments are spoken and what moments aren't. part of what I wanted that red letter to encourage, what I want from the audience, or rather readers most of all, is for them to read this book out loud. I want these words to live off the page. That's part of the point. My grandmother did live off the page. And I hope that even though I'm constructing her story on the page, that at some point during the reader's experience, the words get to live off of the page. An article about and an interview with Diamond Ford, poet. I must save one of this week's articles, and it's in entirety about survivalists. Talk about living off the grid. Then first, I'll have to really shortchange you on this article, but about the Kerry leaders have approved funding for an internal investigation and an employee satisfaction initiative. And I have very little chance to read most of this article, which I read some of the circumstances last week or two. The Kerry Town Council approved a proposal to spend $150,000 on an internal investigation into their former town manager, Sean Stiegel, and another $100,000 on an employee engagement initiative at its regular meeting last week. Both items are part of a bigger effort to repair community trust following Stiegel's December resignation over alleged misuse of town funds and abuses of power. Since Kerry announced the departure in mid-December, residents have been clamoring for more transparency from town leaders about his spending, workplace conduct, and the town council's oversight of his work and behavior. And the council, for its part, has been discussing potential reforms and how to check the town manager's authority going forward. City Mayor Harold Weinbrick announced plans for the internal investigation last month. Immediately following the resignation, Weinbrick said the town had hired Womble Bond Dickinson, a law firm that specializes in this investigation, to join us in looking deeply into Stiegel's activities. Well, I must stop that article and, in fact, stop this whole broadcast from the Indie Week. John Federson here, and I'll be back next week with the next issue, assuming we're not snowed out. And there's one of those storms coming up again. We survived last weekend, and I hope you did too. And so, thanks for listening to North Carolina Reading Service. This program becomes a podcast after Friday when you'll first hear it on the air. So, Indie Week, goodbye from your North Carolina Reading Service.